Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, Unitatis Redintegratio, a scrapbook in sound. Ecumenical landmarks since Vatican II. The Wesleys, hymns to evangelize. And finally, priests knocked off their pedestals. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Why not begin with Pope Benedict XVI's words in English, focusing on the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity, during his most recent weekly general audience.
During this week of prayer, let us ask the Lord, in a particular way, to strengthen the faith of all Christians, to change our hearts, and to enable us to bear a united witness to the gospel. In this way, we will contribute to the new evangelization and respond ever more fully to the spiritual hunger of the men and women of our time.
And now we've listened to Pope Benedict's words, why don't I bring you a sort of archive scrapbook in sound, in which you can listen to Pope Paul VI putting an end to the penultimate session of the Second Vatican Council. In Latin, of course.
Profelici uius concili ecumenici Vaticani secundi celebrazione, cuius laboriose tertie sessioni ac solemni et sacro cetu finem imponimus.
Finem imponimus. With these Latin words, Pope Paul VI put an end to the penultimate session of the Second Vatican Council. The date was the 21st of November 1964, and as always throughout this landmark ecumenical council, our radio station's sound engineers had set up microphones throughout St. Peter's Basilica, where over 2,000 council fathers flanked the aisle. As the Pope was carried in, seated in the gestatorial chair, they broke into the customary chant to acclaim Peter, the rock on which the Church was founded. And as the Pope advanced towards the main altar, the Council Fathers looked up and clapped, and the sound of the music seemed to fade into those immense marble walls of the Basilica. By stepping into the shoes of his predecessor to the See of Peter, Paul VI was cementing what Pope John XXIII had dreamt of when he had first called this 21st ecumenical council in the history of the Catholic Church, 5 years earlier, a momentous gesture which gave birth to the quest of a spiritual spring, described by Pope Paul in these words, quote, "The Council is to be a new spring, a reawakening of the mighty spiritual and moral energies which at present lie dormant." Unquote. And indeed, energies were awakened from slumber, hitting sensitive keys even in the secular media, particularly when discussions centred around such issues as nuns' dress or nuclear warfare. But on this November day, it was end of term and promulgation time for free instrumental documents. A dogmatic constitution on the Church, De Ecclesia, which illuminated the mystery of the Church and recognized the principle of collegiality by which bishops share responsibility with the Pope for the whole Church. And two decrees, the first on Eastern Catholic Churches, Orientalum Ecclesiarum,
Decretum de Ecclesis Orientalibus Catholicis,
which increased the prerogatives of the Catholic Eastern Churches as a bridge between Rome and the Orthodox Church. The second, a decree on ecumenism, Unitatis Redintegratio,
Unitatis Redintegratio,
which fostered new relationships with other Christians.
Inter universos Christianos.
The choir expressed the exaltation. Like all of the other promulgations decided on by the Council Fathers and the Pope, they would number 16 by the end of the 3-year council in 1965. The documents had been up for approval. Let's listen then to the results of the vote on ecumenism.
Decretum vero de ecumenismo placuit patribus bis 1137 dissentientibus undecim.
Only 11 council fathers dissented. 2137 approved. The decree had passed. It deserved an applause. At the time, the concept of ecumenism was definitely new, discussed as it was for the first time by a major church council. A tangible sign of this innovation had been the presence of 45 non-Catholics invited to take part in the council as observers, an initiative which would spearhead many others.
The initiative which we are taking are not to be made in isolation. Rather,
Pope Paul speaking in English only a couple of weeks after the closing of that third session to a group of non-Catholic Christian leaders, a meeting that took place in India, where the first Roman pontiff ever to board an aeroplane was clearly keen to express a change of heart and attitude towards separated Christians, not only in Rome, but the world over.
Through press and radio, through steamships and jet planes, we must come together with our hearts in mutual understanding, esteem and love.
Pope Paul VI was determined to bring the novelties of the Council abroad. And to the Indians who were celebrating a Eucharistic Congress, he repeated that surprise announcement he had made at the end of the third session of the Council.
Attentis! Multarum regionum.
The relaxation of the Eucharistic fast from 3 hours to 1.
Reducatur ad unam tantum oram ante sacram communionem.
An announcement destined to become part of those 6,000 hours of council information broadcast by Vatican Radio during the 3 years of the Second Vatican Council, and carefully archived for you to hear today.
Tum pro sacerdotibus, tum pro fidelibus. Dixit.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. Moving on in the programme, what I'm about to do is change pace and tone and bring you an interview with the Superior General of the Franciscan Friars of the Atonement, Father Jim Puglisi, who heads the Rome-based ecumenical centre Centro Pro Unione, as I ask him to speak to us of some of the landmarks on the path to Christian unity since the Second Vatican Council.
Well, the landmarks since the Second Vatican Council are, first of all, the collaboration that happens between the churches. For example, immediately as the council ended, between the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity, then called the Secretariat, and the World Council of Churches, they formed a joint working group. This joint working group is not technically a dialogue, because the World Council of Churches is not a church, but a council of churches, a gathering of churches. And the attempt was to work on things that they could do together as Christians, both on the religious level, but also on the level of social help that could be offered to the churches. Secondly, were a whole series of dialogues that were begun immediately at the end of the Second Vatican Council, for example, between the Lutheran Church and the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church and the Catholic Church, but not only between churches and the Catholic Church itself, but also between other churches, like, for example, Anglicans and Lutherans, Methodists and Lutherans, Anglicans and Orthodox. So a series of dialogues were begun between the various churches and religious groupings. Then secondly, the collaboration for the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity itself already begun before the Council with Faith and Order and the Vatican is a clear sign of an attempt for the churches to be able to collaborate where it is possible to collaborate. In addition, there were other organizations like an organization called Soda Pax or the Justice and Peace Office of the Vatican, which worked on questions that have to deal with world peace, with justice, and with the integrity of creation. So there have been a whole series of initiatives that have begun, both on the theological and religious level, but also on the social level, that brought churches closer and closer together because they began to collaborate together.
You mentioned integrity of creation. That's the newest issue, isn't it? The most recent.
Well, I wouldn't say so, because really it happened just after the Second Vatican Council. We have different terms for it, but now we call it the integrity of creation. That is, the care for Christians of our environment. This becomes very important because we realize that because of a theology of creation, what we've been entrusted is something that we together have to take care of. And so Christians began to become more and more aware of this, also because it touched upon social issues. For example, churches in the Southern Hemisphere, which have terrible problems with water, with environment, and so that we need to work together to guarantee that for the quality of human life, the quality of creation, that we really do take care of what has been entrusted to us in God's gifts of creation.
Since Pope Benedict made that commitment at the beginning of his pontificate on promoting Christian unity, what would you say the landmarks of his pontificate in this field are?
Since Pope Benedict the 16th has become Pope, one of the most important elements that has taken place is the dialogue between the Orthodox and the Catholics. We all know that the role of the Bishop of Rome is something that has been, as Paul the 6th said already, a stumbling block on the way to Christian unity. And in spite of this, the churches, especially the Orthodox and Catholic Church, have worked together to try to understand how and in what way the role of the Bishop of Rome is necessary for the communion and the unity of the churches. And with the Ravenna Statement, we come closer to an understanding of the role of primacy and the role that the Bishop of Rome needs to play in this communion of churches together. So that's one very important element. The second could be identified the pastoral response that Benedict has offered to Christians of other churches who find it difficult to remain in their own ecclesial tradition today because of various issues. This is not the ideal ecumenical solution, but it is a necessary pastoral solution for those churches and those men and women who need to follow their conscience and don't know how to do that and where to go. So the agreement for the Anglican Ordinariate is seen as a step towards a solution of some pastoral issues that exist. And obviously, various attempts for churches to respond to the pressing needs today, especially in the relationship that we have with other religions, has become a very important step in his pontificate.
What kind of ties do you have with these churches in the Holy Land, these Christian churches, as your group?
Well, the Centro obviously is a place for dialogue and a place for encounter. It provides a space for Christians to come and to talk and also to show what their attempts are in trying to live their faith and how they attempt to concretely work towards a greater sense of their communion and also to express their needs. And I think that's something that's very important. So obviously groups that come from the churches in the Middle East, we offer a space for them to talk, to meet, and to share their opinions and their positions with other Christians, especially here in the city of Rome.
Would you say that the rapport between Christians and other religious groups, something you mentioned earlier, has stepped up a bit in the last 10 years or so?
Well, obviously that is true. It stepped up, if you want, from many perspectives. One, because of the situations that has caused difficulty. For example, most recently, just after Christmas and just before Christmas, the killing of Christians in Iraq and the cops who were targeted in Egypt bring to our attention the need that we have to work out situations where we can live in peace one with another, but also to begin to talk about what are the issues that touch the lives of these people that need to be dealt with. We know that sometimes these issues are political issues and they have nothing really to do with religion, that they are only used as an element to provoke a sense of fear and terror. But we also see with determination that these Christians have made a commitment to say that they are going to live in the land that has been theirs for many years. And I think think we need to support them in that sense, to try to understand what the issues are and to try to offer what support we can in understanding, but also at arriving at solutions that are necessary for people to live in peace with one another.
Why do you think the common perception of a lot of conflicts around the world is given by a lot of people as a religious problem when it's not a lot of the time?
Well, I think because religion is some area of all lives of social reality where there is some dimension that is present in people's lives. If you want, it's something that's the most emotional because it touches lives that deal with symbolic images, or with presence, with symbolic means of expressing one's faith. And when you touch this, you touch something that is a chord that is most deep in people's lives because it touches upon the belief system. And when sometimes we understand or religion is used as a place where we target because we want to discredit one another, we want to put one another in light that is not very positive. We use superstition, we use belief systems, and this is something that is very difficult to deal with rationally. Because you're dealing with highly symbolic systems. You're dealing with belief systems that touch the core of people's existence. These systems sociologically are systems that help individuals come to a deeper understanding of who they are and their relationship with the divinity, with the divine, with their God. They touch deeply the beliefs of men and women. And so I think this is one of the reasons why they become targeted. Because if you can destroy that system, we saw it from reading the pages of the Bible, the wars that went on in Israel between the Jews and their neighbors precisely around this level to eliminate the other, to subjugate the other. And so I think this is something that calls worldwide attention, and to put the label religion on it is the easiest thing. And so people already have a preconception about what religion is about and what is engaged in that. And so I think that's what the media uses. That's what terrorists, I think, use, because they want to say that this is a war between religions, when in many points of view, it is not really that.
At this point, why not continue to focus on the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity, which this year, by the way, has as theme, "We will all be changed by the victory of our Lord Jesus Christ." This time, I'd like to do so on a more musical note with music historian Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
Some families are very gifted. Think of the Bach family with all those composers, or the Kennedy family with so many leading figures in politics, or the Bronte family, those three sisters who wrote such magnificent novels. If I had to single out the family who made the greatest contribution to writing hymns, I think it would have to be the Wesleys. You've probably heard of John Wesley. He founded the Evangelical Revival Movement in 18th century England and America, which grew into the Methodist Church. But it was his less famous brother, Charles, who wrote most of the hymns, over 6,500 of them. I think that has to be a record. Wesleyan hymns were designed for evangelization. They taught Christian doctrine, they stirred up religious fervour, and they attracted new converts. Imagine hearing them sung with great gusto in large open-air gatherings. No wonder people came flocking.
Jesus, the name I love above, in heaven on earth or sky, angels and men before his throne, and devils fear and cry, and devils fear and fly.
A good number of Charles Wesley's hymns are still sung today. One of the best known is probably this Christmas carol. Another is a well-known hymn for the Ascension. These are not the tunes the Wesleys themselves would have known. Many of the tunes were written much later. The tune for Hark the Herald was written by Mendelssohn, and it was the brainwave of a 19th century editor to match the tune to the words, giving us one of the best loved of all Christmas carols. Hail the Day That Sees Him Rise uses a Welsh tune, again written during the 19th century. But the hymn I want to focus on today is normally sung to a tune written by Charles Wesley's grandson, Samuel Sebastian Wesley. Hymn writing certainly ran in the family. Charles Wesley's son, Samuel, was quite a distinguished composer in his own right, but his son, Samuel Sebastian, is the one better remembered nowadays. The name Sebastian was given him in honour of Johann Sebastian Bach, head of another great musical family. Samuel Sebastian worked as organist in a number of Anglican cathedrals during the 19th century. While he was at Hereford Cathedral, he wrote one of his best-known works, the anthem Blessed Be the God and Father. Hereford is the name of the tune that Samuel Sebastian Wesley wrote for his grandfather's hymn, O Thou Who Camest From Above. It's an excellent hymn to sing at a confirmation or an ordination, because it calls on the Holy Spirit to come down and kindle a flame of sacred love in our hearts. There are echoes of St. Paul's second letter to Timothy as we sing, Still let me guard the holy fire, and still stir up thy gift in me. The final goal of the Christian, though, is the union with God which awaits us at our death. We sing of the acts of faith and love which nourish us spiritually in this life, till death thy endless mercies seal and make my sacrifice complete.
Thanks there to music historian Monsignor Philip Whittemore, who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. Finally, let's end the broadcast with a reflection by Monsignor Peter Fleetwood by the title of Living Virtuously.
When the bishops of the world gathered in Rome for the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s, they issued a document which encouraged everyone to be holy, not all in the same way, but in ways which were appropriate for our lifestyles. More recently, Sister Deborah Cirullo asked how people can love God above all else in the midst of ordinary life. One answer is for everyone, religious or not, to practice the virtues of the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience in everyday life. Listen to what she wrote. Because I am called as a sister to live those virtues radically by renouncing ownership of property, renouncing exclusive and sexual friendships, and sometimes by renouncing my own will to the will of another, I have many opportunities to experience and value the virtues of these vows for my life as a Christian. My experiences of trying to live simply in a consumer society, chastely in a society of sexual excess, and with acceptance of my personal powerlessness in so many situations of life, are often no different than those of many others who are trying to do the same. Sister benefits from the fact that she shares her lifestyle and commitment with the other people in her community. But what is worth noticing is that she does not think of herself as someone who has a higher vocation, for example, than someone who is married. She is simply saying that she has extra support in doing something every Christian is called to do. I'm surprised by the number of times people ask me to say a prayer for them. I have no problem with doing that, but I get a funny feeling at times that people are foisting on to me something they're not prepared to do themselves. Sometimes, if I think I know someone reasonably well, I will say to them, "Yes, I will do it, as long as you pray for the same thing." Then sometimes people say with an oily tone, "Oh, but Father, your prayers are so much more powerful than mine." I think, why bother? Smile equally unconvincingly and get on with it. A similar thing happens with children who betray their own unconscious double standards when they tell me that priests are always supposed to tell the truth and behave correctly. When I say that the same applies to everyone, they seem offended. People often proclaim triumphantly that priests have been knocked off their pedestals. Well, as far as I can tell, from more than 20 years trying to become a good priest, we perch there pretty precariously, because we are put there by other people. I'm sure it has always suited people from the most primitive tribes to the most complex civilizations to be able to shift the burden of relationships with the gods onto a few professional, holy people. It's like having a guard dog. If you feed him regularly, he will bark at the appropriate moments and protect you, and stay in his kennel at other times. Some people treat priests and religious sisters that way. If you keep them sweet, they will ward off evil spirits and generate an aura of respectability, and you just hope they keep out of the way for the rest of the time. In times of national grief or disasters, the clergy are very welcome, but they are hardly noticed at other times. If a priest or a nun appears in a doctor's surgery or in a bar, or worst of all, in the close confines of a lift, people become very uncomfortable. If you are interested in some deep thoughts on this subject, you could read some of the books written by René Girard, who has a theory that societies have a fundamental need to create scapegoats whom they can punish publicly. I grew up in a society which treated priests like this, and probably reacted that way myself. But I was shocked into reality by a marvellous Jesuit priest who came to give a retreat at my school. He told us something I've thought about ever since. He said, "You know, boys, my job as a priest is to become obsolete. I have to live in such a way that other people want to love God. It is probably the most powerful reason I have ever had for becoming a priest. Not to do things for people, but to enable them to change, by my example, by teaching, and in all sorts of other ways. In many situations, I have failed, but there have been some good days. People do respond."
You were listening there to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood in this reflection, which is part of the series Why Bother Staying Catholic Despite It All. Monsignor Peter is currently working as parish priest at St. Joseph's Blundell Sands in the Liverpool Archdiocese in England. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Laudetur Jesus Christus.